What I'm going to try to offer over the course of this talk tonight is some essential features of the ocean as human beings can partially understand it. And I want to suggest that this isn't actually as strange and academic as it might seem. I want to suggest that this is actually the way we encounter the ocean when we go to the beach on vacation. We just don't always articulate it. And so on the one level, I'm trying to bring together some historical and literary material, and I'm also trying to capture the feeling that we each have when we stand on the beach and we look at the ocean, and we have that little feeling of difference or slight dislocation of being in the presence of the largest thing on the planet. So I'm going to try to outline three primary features of the ocean as it appears in a poetic or historical sense. First of all, that the ocean is opaque and it resists our seeing through it. Second of all, and this is a phrase that I get from Shakespeare, that the ocean is hungry. And third, that the ocean is transformative. It transforms itself and it also transforms us. Living on land, we sometimes forget how much the sea's physical structures control our physical and cultural histories. We should remember. It's true that poetry can't keep oil out of the Gulf or protect low-lying cities from tropical storms. But it's also true that language is one of the basic tools that our culture uses to grapple with our unstable ocean-drenched environment. Shifting away from the supposed stability of land will cause us to abandon certain kinds of happy fictions and replace them with less comforting narratives, fewer insular Tahitis, and more shipwrecks. But, and this is really my key point, both in the talk tonight, in the exhibition outside, and also in the book, we already have these narratives. We just don't always put them at the center, which is where they belong. The trick going forward will be to replace the tragic narrative of humanity's failed attempts to control nature with less epic, more improvisational stories about working with an intermittently hostile natural world. We need stories about sailors and swimmers and divers to supplement our oversupply of warriors and emperors. These stories are already there. Odysseus swims to shore from his wrecked ship. Ishmael survives the destruction of the Pequod. Robinson Crusoe thrives on his island home. In Shakespeare, Marina, Aegeon, Ferdinand, and Viola all survive immersion, even if Othello, Timon, and Lear do not. These are stories we can use. When we look for the sea, we see it. It's always there. We may not understand the waters, but we know where to find them. The sea's overwhelming presence in our physical and imaginative worlds gives us reasons to reread Shakespeare and Anglo-American history with salt in our eyes. To think about how our fears of flood spill into semi-opaque affirmations and transformations. Because these stories unfold the rich and strange history of our imagined relationship with the biggest thing on the planet. Shakespeare's ocean and the oceans and lost at sea are shifting symbols whose meanings are never exhausted. Their unreachable bottoms conceal treasure and promise death. Reading Shakespeare for the sea thus launches the vast and slightly quixotic project that I call Blue Cultural Studies, a way of looking at our own terrestrial culture from an offshore perspective, as if we could align ourselves with the watery element. What we will find is a painful and joyful history of coming to terms with a world of flux. Shakespeare and Lost at Sea ask us to read as if poetic narratives and the poetic imagination can help us embrace and endure ocean-driven disorder. Whether we can always imitate Shakespeare's shipwreck survivors or Melville's whalemen or Robinson Crusoe isn't certain. But as our world grows bluer and less orderly, these stories have something that we need.